Brigadier Harding Newman, Reel 6. You were just making a final comment about the extent to which RTC elements in Egypt were able and were given full cooperation and integration in the major army training exercises in that area.
Yeah, no, I think we were was never really given the chance to show its full potential in the setting of an exercise. There is that inherent feeling, to my mind, that always the predominant part was given to bringing out the ability of the infantry, supported by, say, cavalry and gunners, rather than trying to set an exercise to see what the ability and capability of the tank was as such. And I think that went on throughout the period I was in Egypt, up to the war, really. One got it emphasized even in later stages after 1935, perhaps more so there, when one had somewhat more difficult commander, perhaps, right at the top end, commanding unit of the tanks in battalion side. But I would say there was never an exercise set by a truly mechanized or armored person with the idea of showing to the other arms what the capabilities, true capabilities of the tanks were. Mm. At the, not anyway for a long time.
Now, the final aspect of this period, 1930 to 35, which I want to deal with, are these two interesting scientific expeditions that you managed to get yourself involved with. The first one, I think, was November-December period, 1932, and this was the expedition that was led by Major Bagnall. How did you get involved with this?
Well, it started when he came back from Egypt in, I think, 1930, when I'd just come out there, and he did a trip then, not as long as that one, but quite one of the biggest which had been done by any number of vehicles, four or five vehicles and personnel, all army, in fact, in those then. And he came back from India to run a second one in 1932. Well, the man he'd had in charge or helping with the mechanical side and entirely in charge of the food and water was one of his own young officers in the signals who, quite honestly, hadn't measured up to what Bagnall wanted. He liked to know exactly what food and what water he had left in relation to how many days and how much reserve we had. Well, this, apparently, this boy could never give him, either from lack of forethought or what, I don't know. But anyway, so therefore, amongst the personnel he already had, with one guy, Prendergast, a great friend of mine, and I think he said, Major Bagnall had asked Prendergast who he could suggest as being a possible replacement, and that's how I came into it in 1932 on the first one. Mark, you that he and Bagnall didn't know so much, but certainly Prendergast knew that I was interested in the mechanical side and had taken part in a lot of these comparatively short but military exercises into the desert with various types of vehicles, and therefore I had an interest in the desert and in the vehicle side. The food side, well, that was just
another job.
That one had to feed oneself, and therefore one of us would always had to look after it and see if we had enough food and rations.
Who was this expedition sponsored by, and what was its purpose?
It was really sponsored by Bagnall. It was under the Geographical Society. In other words, they lent us certain equipment. They provided certain blank maps with the desert surveys. A number of the members were also fellow of the Geographical Society, and it was exploration in its true sense. For Bagnall himself, it was and always called the looking for Zazura, which was the lost oasis.
Zazura?
Zazura, Z-E-R-Z-U-R-A. But it's a word, really, is you're always looking, I think, to see what is over the crest of the next hill, and of course that means you go on forever. And a lot of people never believe there was a true lost oasis, although it has been proved since that there were water supplies known to the Arabs but never to
Europeans.
The Europeans until much later, when they were, one certainly was discovered. But it was always the idea of questing for Zazura, the lost oasis, which led them all on, and was led us, and it was most fascinating. I don't know, do you ever really thought you were going? Yes, I think we did. I think we did think that there was always a possibility of finding this, or a supply of water, an oasis which had not so far been recorded on the maps.
Was it a large and well-equipped expedition?
Yes, for those days it was well-equipped, it was well-organised, it had all that was basically required. It was hard. The members of the expedition did everything there was to be done, which meant they did the navigating, the cooking, the recording of where we went and what we found. And it had to be accepted by the geographical people and the surveys of Egypt. It wasn't just an idea. One had theodolite so that you could locate every camp. And all the any archaeological find had to be recorded exactly where and all about them, and they were handed over to Egypt. We weren't allowed to take any out without their permission. And it was well organized because we never got into the popular press of having killed anyone or lost anyone. And if you do that and you're only recorded in the time, you must know that you are a well-organized and efficient expedition. And we didn't have any problems, I think. Oh, I say we didn't have any problems. Obviously, we had a considerable number of times.
What were they?
Well, breaking of some part which was difficult to repair. We were lucky in 1932. We never left a vehicle behind. In 1930, Bagnall had to leave a vehicle behind, which was later recovered, but it had broken a half shaft, I think, or something. And they could not get the thing to pieces and repair it, so it was abandoned. We were lucky that we never had to leave any vehicles, but we had our problem with broken springs and repairing them. Nothing other than that, not in a major way. But then, again, we hoped. They were all new vehicles, of course, and they were equipped. From the experience we had gained, we had these things called sand mats, and it was due to Bagnall that sand mats were produced in the first place. He, in fact, originally had rope mats, which was just a rope with a bamboo slap between it, about 10 to 15 yards long, which you would roll up and unroll in front of the front wheel of the vehicle. And the other thing he had was the term sand channels, which in fact were galvanized guttering, which were procured from the Sapa stores in Abyssinia. And they were purely guttering for latrine use and that sort of thing, and probably a 4-inch base and sloping side with a turned edge, and they were rather too long. We had to cut them so they fit in between the back and the front wheels, and you put those in when you got really stuck, and then with everyone pushing behind, the chap getting into low gear, you could just get up onto the sand channel. And you stop, soon you got your wheel onto that. Then it stopped, revved up again, and with a bit of pushing, you could probably get out of it entirely, or anyway, go 5 or 10 yards further, and then, you know, do it all over again. Sometimes a lengthy process. And those, of course, were eventually used by the army, both the mat and the channel in adapted forms. And I hope if anyone who goes out there are still used. But they were, I know, forgotten about in the 1950s. It all had to be relearned again by someone who happened to read Bagnall's book or find out about them. But
so the sand mats and the sand channels?
Channels.
These were sort of military spin-offs of these.
That's
civilian,
right. They were purely, rarely produced by Bagnall and his expeditions. And the desert surveys, they came into it too. And let's give them, because, as I say, this man Clayton was always out in the desert. And although he had more personnel to push him out than we did, more personnel per vehicle, black men, Egyptian, Sudanese mostly, his manpower was considerable, where ours was limited to 2 men per vehicle. And therefore you could only, muster 4, 5, 6 at most, and it meant each vehicle had to be got out separately at one at a time, so to speak, got badly bogged.
Were there any other military spin-offs apart from the Sandmats and the
Only the Food, of course, we knew. This all relates really to the final development or the final spin-off which the Army got from the Bagnell expeditions, the Bagnell, and then I'm including Shaw in 1935, was the fact that the LRDG was produced.
Can we leave that for a minute and deal with it when we've come up, when we finish with the Shaw expedition as well? As far as the Bagnell expedition were concerned, if you were to recount it as a sort of story from beginning to end, what were its sort of features and highlights and moments?
Well, Bagnell was we always say, a driver. You always known as the leader. He was an impetuous person and could never sit still. And therefore, though we had archaeologists, botanists, a geologist from Oxford, one of the, I suppose, top geologists, he rarely gave them time to pursue their own particular interests. When we came to an interesting place, say for the geologist, Bagnell was always impatient to get on. He could never say, all right, we'll camp here for a day, and you can have the whole day, or 2 days in some cases, to really do what you want. But he was a brilliant leader, and he achieved a vast amount. But it was, we collected quite a lot of geological information. We mapped a lot of the terrain which had not been covered or mapped before, probably hadn't been travelled for hundreds of thousands of years, which all helped the desert surveys and the map making of the country. And we found quite a lot of matter of archaeological interest and confirmed certain other matter which had been reported upon by previous people, and we confirmed it or found, you know, the more evidence to support their theories. And on the whole, it was, they would term it successful, because we took a lot of photographs of places and people and things. And we did show that a well-organized trip, well-organized expedition with a suitable equipment and cars could go for hundreds and hundreds of miles of absolutely virgin desert and not get lost, record it and get home again, and record what they'd seen of interest to botanist, archaeologist, and that sort of thing. But it was, for me, I mean, a great joyride. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was hard work at times, but it was fascinating, and I think to everyone who went on it, it was a most interesting and free sort of atmosphere.
Surprisingly, you haven't actually mentioned what kind of vehicles were used on the expedition. I'd be interested to know how they compared with military vehicles you'd had so much experience with.
Fords. We used Fords all the time. Bagnell used Fords initially. And in Cairo, you seldom found any British car which was going to be used in the desert or on hard, rough life. They were all American.
Front-wheel drive?
No. Mm. Ordinary Ford, they were all what they call the Ford pickup. In fact, the first lot in 32 was chassis, and we had our own bodies, wooden body, built by a local man there, to Bagnell design. Nothing opened. In other words, you had no, the sides were all fixed, and you had to heave all your luggage, all your stores over the sides or the back, purely because Bagnell said anything that opens, you're going to break. The catcher will go, something will break. Mm. Have the whole thing fixed together, and your body will remain the same, which was very true. And I'd say otherwise, they were absolutely standard Ford from that point of view. We strengthened the springs. We took a lot of spare springs, and we took off all the mud guards, bonnets, as they called them in those days, to save weight. And they didn't look particularly attractive, certainly not the sort of thing which you could go on a military parade, but they were practical, and they achieved the object which we set out to. And that was the same in 1935. We used the same type of Ford car. I think that was the V8, whereas the original one was the A model, which had been superseded. And they actually never had any trouble with them. except for broken springs, broken shock absorbers at times, some of the later models, they put shock absorbers on, and certain stoppages. One particular one I can remember, which I didn't discover for a long time, a petrol stoppage we had every single night for a week or 10 days. And it was caused by the air intake on that particular part of the carburetor was not going through the air filter. And you've got a little tiny little grain of sand in the slow running jet, which meant that every time you would de-clutch and took a foothold, the accelerator, the engine stopped. Mm. Well, you can imagine how annoying that was all the time. But otherwise than that, I mean, eventually when one found the cause, it was easily cured. But on the whole, they were most reliable, and it was the fact that they had, I think what the technical boys would say, a high torque. In other words, each stroke of the engine achieved a slow but positive stroke, which drove you forward. Mm. Whereas in the high-revving mm. English engine, produced because of the tax system in those days, cubic capacity and tax system, was a high-revving engine, which meant your wheel tended to spin and you broke the surface of the sand again, and you dug yourself in, whereas the old mm. Ford, it would chug, 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 and take you out of things which other cars would never do. Mm.
Going on to the second expedition, this is at the beginning of 1935.
That's
right, yes. This was with Shaw. Was that another Geographical Society-sponsored expedition?
Yes. He had been in the Sudan. He'd done camel treks of exploration there. Then he'd done both the Bagnell trips as a navigator, or assistant one, because they had a sap on the 1932, a man called Craig. And Shaw wrote to me and said, would I like to go on another trip, which he was hoping to organise, and I said yes. So all the mechanical side then came onto my shoulders, the whole of the mechanical side and all the food side, and I was the only one then, resident in Egypt, who could produce the thing. Shaw in England, so were all the other members of the party. And except for a short time when he was in Palestine doing work there for the Wellcome Museum, Wellcome Foundation. So all the sort of preparations virtually landed on me to get the vehicles ready, to get the stores all ordered and ready and built up there. And then the rest of the party came out by air and sort of joined the bus when it was ready virtually.
Mm. How did this expedition compare with the Bagnell one?
Doing very much the same work, but there we were all of rather more one mind, not so impatient to get on and cover the ground, as to achieve something in the various walks of life. And when, say, we would come to an interesting spot for someone who wanted to shoot a Barbary sheep or something, or who found there were birds migrating, or the archaeologist, then we would say, all right, we will stay here for a day or 2 days, and we will camp, and everyone can then go about his own particular pet business. And it made it a much more relaxed sort of party, and I think in many ways we achieved a good deal more, certainly from the point of view of archaeology, we did, and from the bird point of view, that we achieved a lot more than we had with Bagnell. And we covered much the same distance, I think between 6,000 and 7,000 miles in the approximate 3 months we were out. Mm.
Looking at these two expeditions from point of view of rather wider implications, in the first place, why was were there any particular reasons why the army was so willing to cooperate with these expeditions?
It was all done on a high level between the president of the RGS, Geographical Society, and the War Office, and certainly in most cases all the members were military. Now, it's the same as you get nowadays at venture training, the military expedition of Everest. The principle is there the same. It is good for personnel to do it. In Egypt, it was particularly for those who thought of a war happening and a war being perhaps on the fought in the Libyan desert or the desert. It was an advantage to have some people who knew something about it. Mm. Equally, in the second time, although it obviously wasn't on the 35 trip, it wasn't sponsored at all by the army, but from the Foreign Office, they did ask to, we should note, where the Italian Huapcu. Remember, they were fighting their Libyan war then. And in fact, of course, they were camped in the Sudan without the Sudan knowledge, because they hadn't gone out there, but we did. So that there was a definite use from the army point of view of having officers who had experience, and they learned. I mean, all we had to put in reports when I came back, and I would say, tell anything of interest. And of course, the survey department of the War Office would get all the mapping things from the geographical. They're very close liaison. In fact, at one time in the Abyssinian War, the War Office had to go to the Geographical Society to get maps of the area we were going to fight over. But I mean, that's what the Geographical Society is for. It has a very, very wide influence and coverage.
Did these two expeditions have any direct or indirect connection with the later formation of the long-range desert group?
Oh, yes, it was entirely due. It was an accident that so often happens in the Bagnell, having known and probably been the most knowledgeable military person about the desert, was being sent down to Ethiopia or Eritrea, and his ship happened to break down, I think, in Malta, and he was transferred to another ship, and he got off the ship and came up to see General Wavell and said, I want to come and stay here and do... suggested the idea of some sort of long-range patrol, as they were called of. But it was purely by accident, and Wavell, I would say, being a brilliant general and seeing a possibility of something really worthwhile, managed to keep Bagnell there. And I was suddenly, I was with the mission to the Egyptian army at that time, and Bagnell suddenly rang me up and said, look, come and see me, on what they then call SS Overflow, which was one of the Thomas Cook's Nile barges moored just on the bank of the Nile there, and said, come and see me. And I was on Friday morning, which was my holiday with the Egyptians, and I went to see him, and it was all very secret and hush-hush and everything else. And he said, well, would you come if we start the patrols of some sort? Will you come? I naturally said, of course I would. And that's how, far as I'm concerned, that's how the LRDD started. Of course, he got in touch with Prendergast, who was in England, Shaw, who was up in Palestine doing his archaeology, and various other people. And then when, I say, I was asked to go, then I was told I was not allowed to leave the Egyptian mission. So I merely had to help in the formation by providing any equipment I had, such as the sun compass, which I bought for the Egyptians, and we provided those. And I also got, I think they had most of the American vehicles which they had ordered for the Egyptian army, which they managed to sidetrack into the British army and equip it. But the great thing was, I think I'm writing saying, the LRDG, from virtually the time it was agreed it could be formed, it was no more than 6 weeks, 3 or 6 weeks, before it took the first patrol went out on active service. We knew everything about what we wanted, how to navigate. We knew the food side, of course, that was then taken over by the medicals and upped it quite a lot compared to what we had. And, of course, they were far more available in the 5 years in the way of rationing and that sort of thing. I mean, all that had improved immensely. But basically, the whole thing was there initially, so that one could, provided you could get the equipment, all we had to do is to get it and get the unit together. And of course, then it's a question of personnel when they got the first two patrol, I think, were New Zealanders, who were obviously the best suited. But that was, Bagnell was the great man on that. But there's no question that without these two trips previously, the LRD, I doubt, would ever have been formed, and certainly could never have been formed in the time and with the knowledge which we had about what was required.
Now, I want to tear you away from Egypt, where it's perfectly obvious your heart is, back to Britain, where you were posted in April, I think, 1935, to 2nd Battalion RTC. You'd been away for some 5 years in a very different scene and working in rather specialized fields. I wondered whether, being dragged back to earth almost, as it were, you were able to notice in a routine UK battalion like the 2nd any striking changes in activities or equipment or attitudes or anything else which might have occurred since your previous home battalion experience?
Oh, yes, the whole thing entirely different. I say Egypt was fun one. The military side was pep wrongly, but nothing like so strenuous or strict as it was in England. And the first thing, one of the first parades I ever went on to in the morning, I can remember, I had no greatcoat, and I was immediately ordered to go and buy a greatcoat straight away because I couldn't appear on parade in a Macintosh or something. And the whole thing was a very strict discipline. Church parades, going on parade with a sword, which I don't suppose I ever did in Egypt, except for a funeral. Yes, one used to for a funeral, that's all. But it was military life in its proper sense, perhaps, whereas Egypt was, and certainly in my experience, nothing like so strict in discipline and attitude altogether. Mm. But it was interesting, and I thoroughly enjoyed my period there. The first time, as I say, really I'd commanded certainly a medium section on manoeuvres. I had a very competent and helpful company commander, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, but it was an entirely different atmosphere. Weekly guest nights, which we very seldom had in Egypt in our small unit we had, and the whole thing entirely and utterly different, but not only different insofar that it was, perhaps one should say, the proper military life or the routine, normal military life in England at that time, which I hadn't experienced anyway for 5 years.
Hey, you were almost immediately thrown into the 1935 tank brigade exercises on Salisbury Plain, which were that year commanded by Hubbard.
That's right.
Do you have any clear recollections of the activities, the pattern, the lessons of that annual training program?
Yes, the whole thing was very strict and strenuous. When I said previously the manoeuvres one carried out were not really strict or strenuous, with Hobo they were. You were given absolute hell, really, at times. He expected you to do everything. I won't say perfectly, but he did expect a lot of one. When I say one, I mean everyone, the regiment, the unit, the personnel themselves. And your map reading had to be absolutely expert on a quarter-inch map. Well, if you ever tried map reading at speed with a quarter-inch map, you'll know what it means. It is something you've got to do for an experience over a long period of time. And of course, I was entirely new to it. And most of the other people in the battalion had done one or two seasons before, and they knew the plain fairly well because it's a limited area, whereas I'd only been done it for a short time, 28, and didn't know it, so I had to be more on my mettle, I suppose, than some of the others. Equally, of course, one relied on those who did know, such as one section sergeant or someone who said, oh, yes, that Tinker's Fir, so you see him up in the skyline, you know where I'd be looking at the map and trying to find it. But it was interesting, I mean, it was efficient, and you felt here was someone and something which was rarely going to achieve something and knew what they were trying to do and were given, to a great extent, the opportunity to do it and to practice armoured warfare as Hobo, Little Heart, and various other of the people had envisaged. And it was a most interesting and strenuous time.
What was the emphasis of the exercises that were carried out in
35? The mobility of the whole force, reconnaissance by the light tank, the 1st Tank Battalion, and then the support of the medium tanks, medium tank battalions, and the mobility and moving at night or moving in any conditions, and particularly at night, with no light, and getting on with it, and arriving at the right time, the right place, with all your vehicles. Mm. And you were expected to do it, and hell for you if you didn't. I mean, whether it be, you know, you as a section commander, or whether it's your company or battalion commander, they equally would all get a rocket from Hobo if they weren't there at the right time. And of course, then you had wireless, and everyone could hear quite a lot of what went on over the wireless, which was made life a good deal more interesting.
How had things seemed to have progressed from the point of view of the efficiency of large mobile tank formations operating on Salisbury Plain as compared with 28, 29 experiences you had?
Tremendous improvement. The whole thing was better organised, and organised for mobility and movement. Your supporting echelons were all more organised for quick refuelling, for proper refuelling. And your navigation, when I say navigation, your map reading, and your wireless, your control. You see, you then started to have, you had the wireless control, and you had control to your internal communication, control to your driver and your gunner.